Welcome to the Pain to Power podcast, where we have engaging, informed, and interesting conversations on topics including women's health, the menstrual cycle, chronic pain, trauma, the nervous system, relationships, and feminism. I'm Lisa DeYoung. I'm a women's health coach, facilitator, and educator, supporting you on your journey of healing, recovery, and moving into a place of personal power in your body and in your life. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 on my journey with period pain and endometriosis. It is a Monday evening here in Dublin, and I'm a little bit lower energy today, but I said I would record this today, and so I've just made myself a lovely cup of ginger and lemon tea, and I've made some notes, and yeah, I'm excited to have a conversation with you about my personal journey with endometriosis and period pain. It's not something that I share on regularly because most of my work is about you. It's about coaching. It's about journeying the path from pain to power. And a lot of my work now is really based on professional training that I have done and my supervision and the skills that I have acquired over the last few years as a coach. But at the end of the day, this career is very much rooted in my personal lived experience of menstrual cycle challenges. And I know a lot of you know that. And so I guess it is important to share because it does help people to relate to me and to understand, you know, the journey that I've been on and the things that I've learned. Having said that, my journey doesn't equate what I sell or offer people. And I make a very clear distinction in my professional coaching practice. That is not something I do. So just bear that in mind that when you're listening to me today, and I'm sure you already do this, just that it's nothing, it doesn't really have a lot to do with your journey, but it can be really helpful for you to learn from my journey and other people's journey with endometriosis and period pain. But the thing about it is that everyone's path and everyone's recovery and everyone's pain management tools and regimes will look very different. So yeah, that's kind of why I want to share on this today. So I'm going to dive right in because I guess this could go on for quite a while. I don't know how long it's going to take for me to share the story, but I've written down kind of the key points in the timeline of the story and the things that I've learned and the things that I had to come up against along the path. So let's just dive in and see how we get on. So I got my first period when I was about 14. and that was relatively okay, except for the fact that, you know, the education back then was just horrific, and that is a whole other podcast. The stories and the teachings on what's called the menarche, menarche, which is the first period of a girl, and we can definitely have a conversation around that again. But my first period was around 14. It wasn't a very welcome surprise, I have to say, but I guess a part of me was excited to be growing up and becoming a woman. And I had pain very, very early on. Actually, I think now that I say it, I actually think that I had my period a few years before that. I think my first period came a couple of years before, and then I had the second one later on. But it was the pain that set in when I was about 14. And now that I'm bringing my mind back to it, yes, I had my first period in primary school, in the last year of primary school. And then my pain experience with my period set in when I was in secondary school. And I remember that distinctly because I remember being at home in my family home, and I was just pottering around the house one day as an innocent girl. I think it was a weekend and I was on my period, and I got this very strange pain in my tummy, and it was a kind of pain that I'd never experienced before. But it was sort of similar to very bad hunger pains, and it was quite peculiar for me at the time. And so I actually remember, it was between meals. Maybe it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or maybe I can't remember, but it was between meals. And I remember thinking, like, that's very strange that I'm so hungry. So I had 2 bananas and the pain didn't go away. And then I also remember at the time, I was an avid reader of teenage girls' magazines. And the one that I read at the time was called Ms. Magazine. I'm sure some of you remember that in Ireland and maybe in the UK as well. And I remember the agony aunt pages talking about periods and, you know, what to do when you got period pain. And one of the pieces of advice that I had been reading before I even experienced period pain was that it was good to get some gentle exercise. So I decided to get some exercise. And at the time, I was very athletic. I was a very athletic kid, really into running and athletics. And I decided to go and run around the garden. And I like ran laps around my parents' garden like a maniac. And I think I actually made the pain worse because I don't think that they meant for me to like do a full on workout. But I did. And the pain just didn't go away. And then I went inside and I told my mum. And I think I would have been still a little bit embarrassed at the time around having my period. And even though obviously my mom knew that I'd gotten it, I wasn't telling her every time I had my period that I was having it. And I told her and she just looked at me and she's like, "Oh, honey, that's period pain. Sit down." So she sat me down in the kitchen and she gave me aspirin. I think that was the first time I've ever had aspirin. And I just sat in the kitchen and I felt quite, I remember sitting there feeling quite defeated. She might have made me a hot water bottle as well. But I just remember thinking like, wow, I really have to sit down and rest. And I remember watching my mum baking and just waiting for these painkillers to kick in. And it was just a whole new experience for me of what life was, because I was so used to being up and about, being energetic, being playful. My body was never a problem. And now all of a sudden, I found myself sitting in the kitchen with my mom and my body was a problem. So that was the first bout of period cramps that I had. And I don't think I'll ever forget it. And I wasn't debilitated with it, but it was the start of what then led to be debilitating pain. So as I journeyed my way through secondary school, my period pain got worse and worse, to the point where I would be completely floored in school and my mum would have to come in and collect me. And I've written down here Mrs. Dobbin. So Miss, we had a French teacher in school, her name was Miss Dobbin, and she was an angel for me because I think she was the only teacher I confided in about this problem. I think at the time I did have a mobile phone, one of the first, like this was pre-smartphone. But we had mobile phones in school and I would have been maybe at this stage, I would have been 15 or 16. And I remember regularly having to text my mom and get her to come in to collect me. But there was one day I remember sitting in French class and I had to leave. And then she came out and sat with me in, there was an empty classroom just off the corridor. And I just confided in her and I was so upset. I was in so much pain and I'd taken a painkiller. I was well used to taking painkillers now at this point. And I had transitioned from aspirin onto paracetamol with codeine, which is a strong, well, not much stronger, but it's a stronger painkiller. And it was just absolutely debilitating. So I have memories of that. I also have memories of sitting in the corridor, waiting for a chemistry class when I was probably 17. And I started to get really bad cramps. And I didn't have a hot water bottle. And I remember just sitting with my friend and I had to get down on the floor and press my lower back up against the pipe that was coming out of the radiator just to get some heat into my flesh, because heat always soothed me. And then I remember just seeing people looking down on me and feeling sorry for me and not really understanding what was happening. But it really, really was very debilitating. And I just never knew what was going on. So throughout these years, I guess maybe between the ages of like 14 to 16 or so, I had been to the doctor several times in Greystones. Sorry, Greystones is the town where I come from in County Wicklow in Ireland. And so it's a little local surgery and the GP there who still practices there, very kind, gentle, you know, kind person. And I think he first put me on, just he gave me painkillers, and I was still quite young. I don't think he wanted to put me on the pill, so he was reluctant to immediately put me on the pill. So I took the painkillers, and then I remember one day I took too many painkillers by accident and I had to go to hospital, and that's another story. But yeah, I didn't take loads and loads of painkillers, but I took one too many of a strong painkiller. I had been prescribed a painkiller called Ponstan, which is a painkiller that you need to get a prescription for. And I took one too many, and I got quite sick on it, and I ended up in the emergency room. And it turned out it wasn't actually the painkiller that was the problem. It was obviously period pain, and I went into a state of panic, and mum thought I'd overdosed. But it was just all very dramatic. So that was pretty heavy for, a teenager, and the struggle with her periods and struggling with painkillers and that kind of thing. Anyway, I eventually was prescribed the pill, which thankfully got rid of the pain. But I also remember being in the doctor's surgery, and because I was under 18, I was accompanied by my mother. And as my mother was leaving the room, I remember the doctor saying to me, and he said to me, "Now, Lisa, if you ever have an accident or anything like that, just, you can always come to me." And he kind of like gave me this stern, serious look. And at the time, I would have been 15, 16, and I didn't know what he meant. And then, a while later, in hindsight, I realized, oh, I want, he clearly thought I was making up period pain to get on the pill so that I could have sex. And so that was sort of a little bit of a disappointing realization when I reflected on that in hindsight, because that wasn't true. Not that that would have been a bad thing, but it was just a kind of an ex like my first experience of, I guess, not really being believed as a young girl. And, kind of my innocence was being questioned, and I still don't feel comfortable with that as I reflect on it. So anyway, that's a little side note to that part of the story. But I was on the pill, and that was good because the pain, what the pill, a lot of you will know this, but the pill stops a woman from ovulating. So the menstrual cycle kind of gets, quote unquote, shut down, and you do have a period, but it's a release bleed, and it's not really like a, quote unquote, real period. So the cramps were minimal, and that was fantastic because I had my quality of life back. However, after I'd say a year on one pill, I started to get side effects. So I went back to the doctor and, told the doctor about that. And then he put me on a different pill. And then I got side effects to that. And then the same thing just kept happening. I just kept getting various different side effects, everything from bleeding through to acne to dry skin to mood changes. And yeah, it was just annoying. It was really annoying. And anyway, then I find myself in university. And I, one summer in university, just had the worst skin outbreak ever. It was so bad. And my skin wasn't great as a teenager. That's something I've also had to journey in, and maybe a topic for another day, because it's very, very linked to hormones, I believe. But I had really, really bad hormonal cystic acne around my chin and jaw. And I just kind of had it. And it was during, when you're in university and you're a young woman, and it was a knock on confidence, and it was just difficult. It was really difficult to navigate. And I started reading into it, and at one point I went to a dermatologist, I think, and she wanted to put me on Roaccutane, and then she explained to me how Roaccutane worked. And anyway, it was just a lot of drama, and I ended up not taking Roaccutane for various reasons once I researched it. But I kind of realized, like, gosh, I wonder, is this pill causing problems for me? And I was just sick of being on this pill that was doing all sorts of things to my hormones. And I didn't really understand what was going on. And I felt very out of control in my body. I didn't understand it. And it was scary. So I remember when I was, when I was about 20, I was in university. I studied French in university, and I had the privilege of going and spending a year in France. And anyway, long story short, around this piece, I decided to come off the pill and see what would happen, and wait for my acne to clear up and just figure out how to deal with my period pain another way. So I did that, came off the pill, and my skin took a while to clear up. I think it took like a good year or so, maybe 2 years. And I did various things to do that, which I can talk about again. But I'm definitely convinced that it was the pill that was causing acne for me. And my period, but the problem was my period pain just came back like really, really bad. And I just sort of managed, I just managed the life through it. I really didn't want to go back on the pill. So I just sort of put up with pain. And, you know, then I got through university. I remember having to like take the train. It's called the DART, DART, the DART here in Dublin. I remember having to get on the DART and come home in pain and being really afraid because I was by myself on the DART with really bad cramps. And then I remember one time mom had to collect me from one of the stations like halfway on the way home. And it was just, again, quite dramatic and upsetting. And I didn't really talk to anyone about it because, you know, back then, no one really talked about periods except for, you know, with your mom or with your friends. I barely mentioned it to anyone. And I don't know how I got through like university, to be quite honest. I just remember every year just like hoping and wishing that my period didn't fall on exam days and just like I somehow managed my life around this monthly, you know, fiasco. And then after university, I was working in corporate. I worked in Google for a while and a few other places. And then I was an English language teacher for international students as well in my 20s after leaving Google. And I just have so many memories of like sitting in bathrooms and having to leave work early and having to call in sick. And it was just this like part of my life. It was just like having a disability, really, without it having been acknowledged. So yeah, it was very confusing and scary, and somehow I'd normalized it into my life. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to share a little bit more in detail, like the nature of the pain that I was experiencing, because it's very easy to just be like, oh, it's just period pain. And I really want to share honestly and vulnerably, like the extent of the pain I experienced and what happened to me while I was in those bouts of pain and the reason why I would have to evacuate the premises. So I would get my period, and just with the onset of menstruation, like before much flow really, with the tiniest drop of blood, I would get very, very lightheaded, and I would knew that it was my period because it would just hit my body suddenly, and I would go into almost like a panic attack. I would get very panicky. And then this didn't happen always, but it was something that happened too often that it should have. My body temperature would suddenly, out of nowhere, go through the roof, and I would have to go to a bathroom and sit in a cubicle. And this happened when I worked in Google. It also happened when I was on holidays with my dad back in 2014. I went to the London Olympics with him, and during we were watching handball, which by the way is a really fun Olympic sport to watch. We were watching this match, and I remember feeling like, oh my God, my period is coming, and I just had to up and leave and go to the bathroom. And I had this episode where, like I said, my temperature just went through the roof, and I would be in this cubicle. I'd have to like strip down, take my clothes off because I was so hot. And my breathing would get really, really shallow, and I would get really lightheaded, and I would have to hang my corpse, my body over the toilet roll holder and lean forward to try and get my blood back into my head. Because if I didn't do that, I would just faint. So I sort of managed to regulate myself away from fully fainting, but I wasn't really conscious, if that makes sense. And then I would get. So all that would happen, like that kind of immune system response would happen to my body, and it would happen very quickly. And then I would get cramps. So the pain would kick in after that, and I'd get these really, really big, like uterine cramps, like so strong, and they'd go down my legs and my glutes and down to my feet. And they never went up my back, but they definitely went down my legs and my glutes and yeah, down to my feet and my calves. And there were kind of gap, like it was kind of like birth contractions, like you know the way they talk about contractions, like they there were gaps between the cramps. And I remember one time when I was sick in bed and mum was with me, she said to me very kindly, like, "Lisa, just relax your body as much as you can in between the waves of pain." And so I had learned that from mum to bring a mindfulness approach to pain when I was out and about and I was caught off guard. I would like be witnessing my body going through this horrendous cramp cycle, but I did have the awareness to be able to sort of breathe and relax in between the pain just to survive. It really felt like that was all I had to do to survive. And then the pain would be quite bad, but then the gaps between the waves would lengthen, and then I would know that the pain was starting to subside. And by the way, this is all with painkillers, because I had gotten good at recognizing that my period was coming and I would take a painkiller. So this experience of pain would happen in addition to me having taken a painkiller. So this was always me sitting in the bathroom and like waiting 20, 40, 45 minutes for the painkiller to kick in and for this whole adrenal response to pain to move through my system. And it just felt like my body was possessed. It just really, really did. It felt like I was completely possessed and taken over by this, I don't know, this horrific thing inside of me. And as the pain, well, it didn't subside easily, but the gaps between the waves of pain would get longer. So I'd have more of a break in between the pain. And then my body temperature would drop, because remember I'd said it'd risen up pretty high, and then it would drop very suddenly. And I'd be kind of sweating as well. And so then because of that, and because I had stripped down, I would suddenly get really, really cold and I'd be shivering and I'd have to put my clothes back on. And then at that stage, the pain would be a lot less intense and I would start to feel the painkiller kicking in, and then I would get this, like, I don't know how to explain it, but I guess it's an oxytocin high. I would get a kind of a high feeling. It was weird, even though I was completely floored and mentally and emotionally traumatized by what was going on. And don't forget, I was alone in very often in places that were away from home when this was happening to me. So it was just all very bizarre. And that was my experience of period pain. And again, not every time, but often enough. So yeah, that was just the kind of the description of my experience of pain. And I'm kind of pausing and pausing as I record this and drinking tea and even noticing myself feeling like, wow, this is a heavy story to share. So I'm gonna just name that. And I also want to name the impact of this experience that people have on one's mental health, because something that also happened to me was, and it didn't happen always, but I would have suicidal ideation during this experience as well. And there were times where I would have to throw the painkillers to the other side of the room because I just didn't feel comfortable having boxes of painkillers next to me while I was going through this amount of pain. So that was also very, very real and something I've had to look at, I guess, and something I want to acknowledge for anyone who's listening who goes through endometriosis symptoms or PMDD, that being suicidal or suicidal ideation, I think, is very common and somewhat normal, considering what you're experiencing in your body. And that, you know, you're not alone. You're not alone with that. I certainly did feel alone, but I learned that I wasn't, and I got help with that. And there is help out there. So I just want to normalize that as it being a part of the experience, because it's something I don't see talked about enough. And because I experienced that myself, I just thought it's important for me to share that. That then brings me to kind of like the turning point of the story, where at this point I was managing pain and not on the pill in my early 20s, and I just was a bit sick of it at this point, and I decided to go back to the doctor. I was living in a new house in Dublin with some housemates, and I remember going to the local GP and saying to her, like, "Look, I need help. This has been a problem for a very long time, and I've been on the pill, lots of pills, and I don't really want to be on the pill anymore. Like, you guys need to help me with this. And nothing really came of that, to be perfectly honest, except for that I had researched endometriosis and I brought that label into the surgery myself. No one had ever said that to me before. I brought it into the doctor's surgery and I asked her about it, and she said, yeah, maybe it is, but like, it's a very drastic thing, you know, condition to have to diagnose because you have to get surgery. So let's just put you on a different pill. Let's put you on, I think it was microlight, like a quote unquote lighter pill. And so I, you know, agreed with that because I wanted to trust the doctor and I didn't want to go for surgery, and it sounded horrific what she was sharing with me around endometriosis. So I took the prescription for the pill. I got the pill, I think I got 3 months. I got them dispensed in the pharmacy next door and brought them home and shoved them into the back of the cupboard. I just could not bring myself to go back on the pill. I was just so fed up. I was fed up with there being no answers, just being given the pill. And I knew there was something wrong. I knew there was something off and there was something underneath this. And the experience I was having with pain was beyond normal. And I was just so determined to figure it out. I had to do something. So that's when because I had worked in Google, I was very good at Google search. This is now 10 years ago, before all these wonderful books have been written on menstrual cycle and hormones. It was very early in the kind of menstrual cycle awareness, you know, awakening of the world. There wasn't really much information, but I got on Google and I found a woman called Elisa Vitti, whose book I really recommend. It's called Woman Code. And it's all about how your diet and your lifestyle, you know, impact your menstrual cycle, and really starting to think about your hormones and stress hormones and how everything is interconnected, and how beauty products and even household cleaning products and the parabens in these products can contribute to hormonal imbalances. And it was just an incredible book to read. And I watched her talk. She did one of those talks at Google on YouTube, and I found it. And I was just, my mind was blown, because I was there like suddenly being awakened to this information and this knowledge and this awareness around, it's not just your period, your whole menstrual cycle matters. Every week matters. It's all relevant. And learning to understand the cyclical nature of the menstrual cycle, and that the lifestyle you live and the things you put into your body have an impact on your hormones and can cause either health or, you know, pain and suffering. So that was amazing for me to discover that. I felt like a whole world had opened up for me. And at the time as well, I'd started doing mindfulness meditation. I was carrying a lot of emotional, a lot of emotional stuff, you know. I hadn't ever been to therapy, hadn't ever done coaching or anything like that. And I was just trying to get through life, struggling with my mental health and physical health, that were both very intricately connected. And so between the understanding of lifestyle and mindfulness, and then I started to do meditations on body parts. And I remember one time I was doing a mindfulness exercise. I decided to do a mindfulness exercise on the womb. And again, this was way before, you know, mindfulness had become commonplace. And I was just doing it secretly in my bedroom and not really telling anyone. And I was buying all these books about meditation and doing it and like just experiencing this new feeling in my body. And there was one video that had suggested to do heart meditations, and that was, you know, a common enough one at the time. And I was like, well, if you can do a heart meditation, I've got a problem with my womb, so I'm going to do a womb meditation. So I switched it around and did a womb meditation, and I kind of didn't really expect much to come of it. I was really in experiment mode and I was desperate and I was just willing to try anything. And I remember I was on my way out the door. I was going home. My brother had gotten engaged and there was a dinner with his in-laws and my parents. And I was all dressed up and I had my mascara on and ready to go. And I had an extra 10 minutes before I needed to leave. And I thought, oh, I'll do this meditation now. And anyway, did the womb meditation, brought my awareness to my womb. And once I got into a meditative state and, you know, though just it opened up a whole can of worms. Let's just put it that way. I just suddenly realized, like, oh my God, there's so many emotions here. All my life, I've been rejecting this part of my body. Every single time I've gotten my period, all I kept thinking was, I either don't want to live or I want to get a hysterectomy and I'm only 21, do you know? So there was just a lot of trauma. There was a lot of grief. There was so much, there was a lot that needed to be released. And I'm really grateful. Even as I speak to this story, I'm so grateful for my younger self who was wise enough to know to, fuck all the advice that the doctors were giving me or lack thereof and go off on my own path and, read the books and use my skills to search Google really well for different resources and start doing meditations and even experimenting with those things, And it was just like, I was quite resourceful and creative in my own healing journey from an early age. So yeah, that was definitely a big awakening for me in terms of my own mind-body connection and I guess trauma, and the somatic nature of the self and the feminine cycle and all of the stuff I talk about now and understand very deeply. And then I discovered Red School. And if you've had a look at my website, Red School are the school that I trained with. They train professionals to be, I guess, menstrual cycle awareness coaches and leaders. And that's where I did a big part of my training. It's called the Menstruality Leadership Program, and got to meet Shani Huger-Wurlitzer and Alexander Pope, who I just adore and, were just beacons of light on my journey. And I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail about that program here now because I think it deserves its own podcast. But that was an incredible journey for me because then that's where I learned menstrual cycle awareness and understanding the energies of the menstrual cycle, the shadows of the cycle, the inner seasons, the archetypes, the nuances of such, the inner critic, the creative cycle, self-care around the cycle, spirituality, like all of the stuff that I now bring into my coaching. And it was, just a huge, huge part of the next steps for me. And it was a really big part of me stepping into kind of a professional place as well in this capacity. And so I was doing that. And I also, at the time, it's 2016 now, I would have been 26 or 7. And I decided to go for, even though I was doing all this lifestyle stuff and I was doing healing and therapy and I was like, doing it all, ancestral healing, everything. And then menstrual cycle awareness work. I also was navigating the medical system and I had decided to go for what was called a laparoscopy to get the keyhole surgery that would diagnose and treat endometriosis. So I got that in 2016 in Dublin and was diagnosed with endometriosis. And I was delighted because I finally had a label. Well, I wasn't delighted. I was very upset because it had taken me, how many years is that? 14 years. Took me 14 years to get my diagnosis. And that was also very traumatic. And again, another story because the anaesthetist made a mistake and gave me a medication that I shouldn't have gotten. And, there was sort of drama, just drama with that part of the story. And I also didn't realize like getting surgery was a big deal. Then I didn't really employ the right supports. And I was pretty upset, it was just upsetting. I didn't understand and I didn't even know how to choose a surgeon properly. I just kind of thought, well, just go for the surgery and who, whatever surgeon's available is good for me. And anyway, so I won't say much on that, but just that took 14 years to get diagnosed and had the diagnosis. I was told that there was endometriosis on my uterosacral sacral ligaments. And that was ablated away. So the technique that they used was to burn it away. And then I was also told if I ever, if I ever was struggling to get pregnant, I could just come back and do another surgery. And that was kind of the advice. So I was excited about the endometriosis being gone, and I'd been reading about surgery and I'd seen that, it can take a few months for you to recover from surgery and the pain after a laparoscopy, as in the period pain, can be worse. So, which it was. So period pain was not fun. And I never really recovered because you know, the surgery didn't really treat me. So I then went back and I continued to focus on lifestyle, diet, managing stress, doing something called Maya massage therapy, acupuncture, just all the other things that I was trying. And they were helping. My pain did come down a good bit, in fairness, and I managed to regulate my nervous system a lot. But what then happened, fast forward into, this was 2016, then fast forward into 2021, and my pain was getting worse for some reason. And I was getting the symptoms were shifting slightly. I was getting really bad pain upon bowel movement during my menstrual phase, really, really bad, to the point where I'd scream in the toilet. And I was also getting chronic fatigue with menstruation, to the point where I couldn't cook. I couldn't stand in the kitchen. I could hardly work. And that was worrying. That really worried me. So I then started to do more research, more reading, and I had been well aware of women traveling abroad from Ireland to the UK and other countries for endometriosis surgery. And that had caught my attention, and I'd been following the work of the Endometriosis Association of Ireland as well quite closely, and they'd sent me a lot of resources. And it took me a while to kind of get to looking into that, because it is a whole job. It's kind of a full-time job. If you have endometriosis and you want to get treated abroad, or if you want to just get treated actually, because GPs know so little, you have to do it all yourself. It's basically project management of your own health and making decisions, researching. You know, it's very difficult. It's very emotionally draining. It's very time consuming. And it took me a while to kind of get my head into a place where I needed to do that. And then don't forget, the people who are doing that are also the patients, so they're also the ones who are suffering with this disease and sick a lot of the time. So it was a lot of energy. But thankfully, I went on to Nancy's Nook, and Nancy's Nook is the Facebook group that I mentioned in my previous episode, episode 2, all about endometriosis, taking back your power. So you can check that out. But anyway, I ended up then in London. I decided to just to get a consultation with one of the surgeons, the expert surgeons in the UK. And that was mind blowing, because he essentially told me, he said, "Lisa, okay, you've been diagnosed with endometriosis in 2016 on the usual sacral ligaments. But from my extensive experience of treating women with endometriosis, it's never just found on the usual sacral ligaments, and it's usually in other areas too." And that was quite shocking, but also helpful. But yeah, I was pretty upset when I got that information. And he also spent an hour with me, maybe an hour and a half. He spent a long time with me, and he went through all my symptoms, asked me, you know, really specific questions. And the first question he asked me was, did you have to miss school as a kid? And obviously, you know, based on the story I just shared, yes was the answer to that question. And I just thought that was very revealing. He also was the surgeon who explained to me the difference between different types of pain. And he said the reason why I was having the temperature going up and down and fainting, which as a separate kind of event to physical pain, was because my immune system was very much involved, and that I have a sensitive immune system, and endometriosis is an immune dysfunction. And what happens when you have what's called an endo flare, the immune system can flare up and try to attack the endometriosis tissue, which I explained again in the previous episode. And it just was so easy for me to understand, because I'm not a doctor, right? But I understand the role and the function of the immune system, and I understand, you know, how the menstrual cycle works. I also have an understanding that as humans, we all have cells in our body that the immune system needs to fight off every once in a while. And if it doesn't succeed in doing that, then it can become cancerous or whatever. And I also have a basic understanding of how autoimmune diseases work. And it just was so upsetting for me with my non-medical brain to understand these things. And I said to him, when he was telling me all this, I just looked at him shocked. And he said, you know, I was like, how come no one's ever told me this before? And he just looked at me and he said, Lisa, doctors don't know this stuff. They just don't know this stuff. So yeah, so it was like a lot of emotions, because obviously I was really happy to be in good hands and I felt very heard and I was with an expert and he knew exactly what he was talking about and he was giving me a lot of time, you know, and taking my condition very seriously, which it had never been done before. But at the same time, I was angry and full of grief because I realized like this is not that complex to sort of not necessarily diagnose, because, OK, you do have to get the surgery. But the red flags for endometriosis are pretty obvious. And it just shocks me that A, doctors don't know it, and B, the amount of misinformation that doctors have. Like now as a coach in this space, supporting women navigating the medical system, I've heard horrific stories. Like one client told me that she brought the prospect of endometriosis to her doctor and the doctor dismissed it and said, no, because if you had it, you'd have pain all month long, which is bullshit. And then I had, well, I wasn't a client, but I was speaking to someone recently as well and about it. And she, her experience was that her doctor thought she was having too much sex, which is why she was having pain during sex. And it's just like, I actually just can't even express my shock and my disappointment at the medical system, particularly here in Ireland, at the lack of knowledge, the lack of understanding, the lack of even wanting to try to understand this condition in terms of, you know, the GP level. And why is there not a CPD program or a system or a requirement or something in place so that every single doctor in this country has a very clear understanding of the nature of this condition, the red flags, the symptoms, the role of the immune system, things to look out for, how to speak to the patient, an understanding of maybe their own, you know, internal biases, conversations around gaslighting, conversations around trauma, conversations around medical misogyny. You know, we really need to be addressing these problems at the GP level, and I really hope we do. I really, really hope we do soon. So this brings me on to the next part of the drama in the story. So that was grand. I had my appointment with the doctor in London and he said to me, you know, here's the facts, here's the stats, this is what I can do. And it's your decision whether to take to have surgery or not. And it's not guaranteed. Grand. So obviously I had to make that decision and I decided to go for it, decided to get the surgery and with him. And I had to go back to Ireland and just get my ducks in a row in terms of paperwork and stuff to get the surgery. So I am someone who's very privileged to have health insurance. And this is a whole other dimension to the story because, yeah, I'll just go into it. And I'll speak to my part, my personal story, but I'll also comment on the systemic problem. So I have health insurance with a particular Irish health insurance provider, and the surgeon encouraged me to get the health insurance company to approve the surgery with him in London. And he said, the insurance provider that you're with, because it's also very interesting, he'd so many Irish patients come his way that he knew the differences, but he knew the differences between each Irish provider and like what requirements belong to which and all that. So that was also very revealing. Anyway, my particular health insurance company, the case was that I had to go back to Ireland, find an Irish gynecologist consultant and get them to sign this, what's called a prior approval form for a treatment abroad. And essentially what that is you're going into a gynecologist's office in Ireland, telling them you want to get treatment abroad, and they have to sign a form that says that they can't do that particular surgery and that Lisa needs to go to another country because what she needs is not available in the country. Okay, so that's what I needed. That's what I needed to get done. And as my doctor in London was explaining this process to me, he just looked at me and he was like, and by the way, it's going to be very hard for you to get that form signed because not many consultants are willing to send women my way, because they think that they can do it themselves. So I was again, angry, shocked, and disappointed. And I just looked at him and I said, are you serious? I have to go through the mill after everything that I've been through the last 14 years. Now I have to go back and fight the medical system in Ireland and go through the mill with this. He's like, yeah. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I get back to Ireland and I swear to God, like that, it was about 3 months that I was trying to navigate this. And don't forget, my symptoms were really bad and I needed treatment. I decided to go back on a progesterone-only pill for a while, which was actually horrific because it just actually caused more problems than good. But I thought it would help my pain, but it didn't. Anyway, I went back to Ireland and I then had to go through my GP, because in Ireland you have to go through your general practitioner to get an appointment with a consultant. And because of COVID and everything, it was, you know, there were these appointments, there were long waiting lists. So I went on a few waiting lists and I just thought to myself, like, oh, I'm never going to get this form signed. I then decided to go back to the surgeon who treated me in 2016 in Dublin and explained to her what happened and why I want to go abroad. And she refused to see me. And she said to me that she would refer me on to her colleague who had an interest in endometriosis. So that was really very upsetting. I was very angry about that. And I decided then to get my GP. I had a very supportive GP and I just said to her, look, let's just try and get an appointment with whoever will see me. So I think I booked like 4 or 5 appointments with different consultants in Ireland and decided I needed to arm myself with research. So I downloaded research papers from medical journals and put a case together for myself to support them in their liability and their decision to sign the form to send me abroad. But again, as I said, very difficult. I was on a few endometriosis support groups pages on Facebook here in Ireland, and I asked around and I was like, look, like, does anyone have a surgeon who signed this form? And one of the women replied to me and said, oh, you probably just need to go and get another surgery in Ireland and, you know, let them have a, this was her words. She said, you need to let them have a go at you first. And then for that not to deliver results, and then they'll sign the form to allow you to go abroad. And I was just like, that's not happening. I've already gone through surgery once before unsuccessfully, like as in, okay, I got the diagnosis, but I didn't get treated. And I'm not letting another surgeon mutilate me. I want to get this surgeon abroad and this is my choice and I have the right to choose the surgeon. So I was very, very upset. I was very stressed every single day. I was trying to navigate work and my life in general and pain. And I remember just going for endless walks around the park. I was doing laps and laps and laps, and I had gone back to therapy just to help with the emotions of it all. And I had a lot of emotional support. But it was a very, very difficult experience. And I will say this, the Irish insurance company that I'm with and the medical system and the way that it's set up with endometriosis care, I didn't want to go abroad for surgery. I should have gotten treated here in Ireland. That should be available here, as in the expert surgery and the right techniques and tools should be here, which I think they are working on. But I was actually prevented from going abroad. I was being blocked both by my health insurance provider and by the medical system because of their ego and because of medical misogyny. And it was contributing to what was already a very traumatic situation. And I was one of the lucky ones because I have health insurance. So yeah, I'm very angry about that. Totally owning my anger. And one of the reasons why I'm angry about this is because of the professional position I hold, I speak to a lot of women in similar but very different circumstances and contexts. And, you know, I didn't know what the problem was. And I was so confused as to why there were so many women in this country who were struggling in pain and were getting nowhere in the medical system. And now it's very obvious to me. It's because of medical misogyny. That's all I can say. And you know, the lack of understanding and the lack of it being patient-centered, the lack of it being trauma-informed, and the gaslighting that occurs. And it's just so much worse than I thought it was. I thought, you know, I knew that those things were very real, but the more I do this work and from my own personal experience, you know, and I'm not being dramatic, trying to not be dramatic. I really am speaking to my lived and professional experience of this. It's actually worse than I thought it was. Anyway, so what you have to do, what I had to do was, because if you're in an oppressive system, you can't exactly take down the system. And that's, you know, it's a lot of work. We've tried that. So you have to work with the system. And I, you know, I had my own coach help me with that. And you have to kind of navigate and pull strings and, you know, think outside the box and get the system to work with you. So that's how you get out of those, if you can. It's not actually not possible for everyone to do, but if you're lucky and if you're privileged enough, to be quite frank, you can figure out how to get out of the system. So what I then did was I got good at Google search again. And I found a doctor in Dublin who serves the Polish community, and he is a consultant because the insurance company needed a surgeon who was consultant level. So he was a consultant, but not practicing as a surgeon, but he was practicing as a GP, but registered with the medical council as a consultant. And so I made an appointment with him. He saw me the next day. I brought all my files to him and explained to him over the phone what I needed. I was like, I need this form signed. Can you do this? I want to go abroad for endometriosis treatment. And he was like, sure, come on in. Went to his surgery, which was mad. It was during COVID. Went into the waiting room and there were all these husbands and male partners of women taking up all the seats in the gynecologist's waiting room. So I stood there with my mask on. Nobody was wearing a mask. There was like disco music playing in the waiting room. It was just so bizarre. It was really a very different experience for me. And then there was like a lady doctor running across the hall into his surgery office and interrupting him mid-patient checkups. And it was just very chaotic. And I was just like, what am I doing here? This is very weird. But I need to just not leave here until I get this form signed. So I stood there. Eventually I got a seat in the waiting room and had my, you know, was gripping onto my insurance company form and went into him and explained to him the situation again. And he looked at me and he said, oh, if you want to, the only solution for endometriosis is pregnancy and breastfeeding. And I nearly burst into tears. I just thought, oh my God, I'm never going to get to be able to go to this surgeon in London. And it was bizarre. He took my form and he kept saying this to me. But as he was saying what I think is a very sexist comment to make, he said, he started to fill in the form and he started, you know, signing the different parts that he had to sign. And I was ready to rage at him and burst into tears and shout, because sometimes I can do that. And but something inside of me just said, Lisa, shut up, don't say anything, just keep your mouth shut. He's signing the form. Just let him say what he needs to say. Let him out with his misogynistic crap about needing to get pregnant and it's the only solution for endometriosis. And you know, he's signing the form, just get out of there with the form signed. So I took it, I took the crap, and he only took cash or PayPal. So he took my phone and inserted his email address and paid himself over PayPal, 50 quid, no receipt. And I got my form signed. So that's how I managed to get to London. And I do have that story, by the way, written down with all the names of different doctors in the Endometriosis Association of Ireland forms. So if you need the names of any of those doctors, you can do that there and get that there. But the reason I'm telling you the story is to just highlight the barriers to access, the, you know, that it's very privileged, that it's still filled with sexism and misogyny and gaslighting and lack of information and miscommunication. And I had a friend as well at the time when I was trying to get abroad to London. I had a friend reach out to a former gynecologist who was quite high up in Ireland, who's now retired. And she said to him, oh, you know, Lisa's being very irresponsible for wanting to go abroad because this treatment is available in Ireland, which it isn't. There's no expert surgeon in Ireland who only does excision surgery and who works with a multidisciplinary team. Listen to episode 2 to explain why that's important. So I was just, you know, it was just really, really, really stressful, very horrific, very upsetting, and got my form signed, wrote like a 3 or 4 page letter to the insurance company, sent them all my medical history, printed everything off. I sent them a whole file, like it looked like a PhD, and they then approved the insurance cover within, I think it was 36 hours. So proud of myself. I'm pretty sure I had champagne when that got approved, and I got to go to London for a surgery, which is what I really wanted to do. So anyway, I'll bring you to the end of the story because we're getting into an hour now of this podcast episode, but got to London, had the surgery, very well looked after, couldn't have been looked after better, but it was very traumatic. It was a very extensive surgery, excision surgery during a pandemic in a foreign country. Not cheap either, had to pay for obviously accommodation and you know, transport and all that. And my sister was with me. Then I was also very afraid. I was really, really scared of going under the knife again. And my biggest fear was that I was going to have to go through surgery and recover from surgery, and that the surgeon was going to tell me that he couldn't find any problem, that I didn't have endometriosis. That was the fear. And I believed it, and I thought that's what was going to happen, but I was doing it anyway. And I woke up from surgery and he came round to my bed and he looked at me and he said, "Lisa, we found endometriosis and treated it in 4 areas. And oh, I think I fell in love with him there. And then I was so high on drugs. I was so happy. So relieved that I took that risk and got proper treatment. Even as I'm saying it, I'm feeling emotional. And then I went into recovery, was very well treated by the nurses. And the next day he came into me and he had a video of the surgery. And, you know, he spent about half an hour with me explaining what he found and discovered that it was very subtle, but in an area that was very near a lot of nerves. And, you know, it required his technique to remove it and treat it. And, you know, there was also no guarantees either with his treatment. So I had to wait a few months to see. I had a 6-month follow up there in January. And I'm really, really glad to say that my pain has drastically reduced. I hardly need to take painkillers at all. I've recovered from surgery itself. That was also very traumatic. I also had a lot of rage and anger that I needed to work through in therapy. Like really, 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 and just very dysregulating amount of rage. And I'm really, really, really grateful that I now have minimal symptoms. That's not to say I don't need painkillers and I don't need to look after myself. I still do get pain, but I'm not fainting. I'm not having suicidal thoughts, throwing boxes of painkillers across the room. I'm not having to isolate, and I still have fear of pain. That's very real. I still have fear of my pain coming back and all that. And I still have to learn to trust my body. And I don't know, this is the thing. It's a very complex condition and it can return and it can grow back. And I'm working with my own coach. I actually, when I was going through all of this drama, like last year, in 2021, I was thinking to myself, I need a me, like I need someone like who does what I do, but I need to someone hold space for me. So I hired my own endometriosis coach who focuses very much on diet and nutrition and lifestyle. And she helped me through before, during and after surgery as well, recovering from that and just getting kind of a protocol in place for managing this condition, because it is a condition that you really do live with and you have to learn to manage, because it's not completely curable. And, you know, I was very lucky that the surgery brought a lot of relief and that I was privileged enough to be able to access it. But my God, it really showed me what happens in the system, in women's health, in Ireland, in the insurance companies, in the GP's office, in just all of it. Like, I feel like I see it all. I know it all. I've also heard a lot of women. I've spoken to a lot of women about their experiences. And all, I will say as well, like there are, of course, I have spoken to them, women who have had ablation surgery here in Ireland, which tends to be less successful, but they've had, they have benefited from that. That's helped them. So I am not saying, again, going back to the first point I made on this podcast episode, I'm not saying that my way is the only way and that you must travel and that you must get excision surgery. I'm just saying that these were my choices based on my own personal research and based on my own personal experience. And these were the barriers that I was up against. And when I got the treatment that I chose, I got better. And it took me, I've written down here, 19 years to get treated for endometriosis and 14 years to get diagnosed. So yeah, it's crazy, right? So crazy. So I'm going to bring this podcast to a close here because we're into the hour mark, and it is a bit of a heavy one. It's a bit of a dark one, but there's a lot of hope. And I hope that you took something from that story. I hope you felt you learned something. I hope you maybe felt inspired. Maybe you agreed with things, disagreed with things. I'd be very curious to hear your thoughts or even hear your story. You can absolutely write into me, lisa@lisadeyoungcoaching.com. I also have a free course all about endometriosis. It's called Endometriosis, a Self-Care Journey, which is all about learning to manage endometriosis, navigate the medical system, and take care of your body, your hormones, your nervous system with this painful condition. You can get that on my website, lisadeyoungcoaching.com, although it might still currently be yourcyclematters.com, but you can find it. And I'm also taking consult calls. So if you want to do one-to-one work with me, if you feel like you can benefit from one-to-one support, which I highly recommend, I've invested in a lot of one-to-one support myself, do consider it. We can just have a chat on a consult, see where you're at, see what your needs are, and I will see you there. Thanks for listening, guys, and lots of love for the week. Thank you for joining today's conversation. This community, these topics, and the stories I share are not possible without all of you being part of the journey. If you are interested in getting more support for your own personal process, head on over to my website, lisadeyoungcoaching.com, to book a consultation call with me. Or you can sign up for a free course there as well. And as always, please like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. Lots of love for the week, and see you next time.